for 8 days this year. That's good. I know I shouldn't, but I just get this compulsion early in the morning. Maybe it's low blood sugar. I think it might be that. Anyway, I ate the rest of the pound cake that was in the fridge. Then I got in the car and drove down to Dunkin' Donuts, and I got a dozen of the Dutch apple and four of... Henry, still thinking about the annual hunting trip that starts tomorrow, isn't aware of what he is saying until it is out. Maybe this compulsive eating, Barry, maybe it has something to do with thinking you killed your mother. Do you think that's possible? Barry's words stop. Henry looks up and sees Barry Newman staring at him with eyes so wide they are actually visible. And although Henry knows he should stop, he has no business doing this at all, it has absolutely nothing to do with therapy, he doesn't want to stop. Some of this may have to do with thinking about his old friends, but most of it is just seeing that shocked look on Barry's face and the pallor of his cheek. What really bugs Henry about Barry, he supposes, is Barry's complacency, his inner assurance that there is no need to change his self-destructive behavior, let alone search for its roots. You do think you killed her, don't you? Henry asks. He speaks casually, almost lightly.
I resent...
She called and she called, and she said she was having chest pains, but of course she said that often, didn't she? Every other week, every other day it sometimes seemed. Calling downstairs to you, Barry, phone Dr. Withers, Barry, call an ambulance, Barry, dial 911. They have never talked about Barry's parents. In his soft, fat, implacable way, Barry will not allow it. He will begin to discuss them, or seem to, and then, bingo, he'll be talking about roast lamb again, or roast chicken, or roast duck with orange sauce. Back to the inventory. Hence, Henry knows nothing about Barry's parents. Certainly not about the day Barry's mother died, falling out of bed and pissing on the carpet, still calling and calling, 300 pounds and so disgustingly fat, calling and calling. He can know nothing about that, because he hasn't been told. But he does know. And Barry was thinner then, a relatively svelte 190. This is Henry's version of the line, seeing the line. Henry hasn't seen it for maybe 5 years now, unless he sometimes sees it in dreams, thought all that was over, and now, here it is again.
You sat there in front of the TV listening to her yell, he says. You sat there watching Ricky Lake and eating, what, a Sara Lee cheesecake? A bowl of ice cream? I don't know. But you let her yell.
Stop it.
You let her yell? And really, why not? She'd been crying wolf her whole life. You're not a stupid man, and you know that's true. This sort of thing happens. I think you know that, too. You've cast yourself in your own little Tennessee Williams play simply because you like to eat. But guess what, Barry? It's really going to kill you. In your secret heart, you don't believe that, but it's true. Your heart's already beating like a premature burial victim beating his fists on the lid of a coffin. What's it going to be like 80 or 100 pounds from now?
Shut.
When you fall, Barry, it's going to be like the fall of Babel in the desert. The people who see you go down will talk about it for years. Man, you'll shake the dishes right off the shelves.
Stop it.
Barry is sitting up now. He hasn't needed Henry to give him a hand this time, and he is deadly pale, except for little wild roses, one growing in each cheek.
You'll splash the coffee right out of the cups, and you'll piss yourself just like she did.
Stop it!
Barry Newman shrieks.
Stop it, you monster!
But Henry can't. Henry can't. He sees the line, and when you see it, you can't unsee it. Unless you wake up from this poisoned dream you're having. You see Barry, but Barry doesn't want to see. Absolutely will not see. Out the door he runs, vast buttocks jiggling, and he is gone. At first Henry sits where he is, not moving, listening to the departing thunder of the one-man buffalo herd that is Barry Newman. The outer room is empty. He has no receptionist, and with Barry gone, the week is over. Just as well. That was a mess. He goes to the couch and lies down on it. Doctor, he says, I just fucked up. How did you do that, Henry?
I told a patient the truth. If we know the truth, Henry, does it not set us free? No, he replies to himself, looking up at the ceiling. Not in the slightest. Close your eyes, Henry. All right, doctor. He closes his eyes. The room is replaced by darkness, and that is good. Darkness has become his friend. Tomorrow he will see his other friends, three of them anyway, and the light will once more seem good. But now, doctor? Yes, Henry? This is a bona fide case of same shit, different day. Do you know that? What does that mean, Henry? What does that mean to you? Everything, he says, eyes closed, and then adds, nothing. But that's a lie. Not the first one that was ever told in here. He lies on the couch, eyes closed and hands folded on his chest, and after a little while, he sleeps. The next day, the four of them drive up to Hole in the Wall, and it is a great 8 days. The great hunting trips are coming to an end, only a few left, although they, of course, do not know this. The real darkness is still a few years away, but it is coming. The darkness is coming. 2001, Jonesy's Student-Teacher Conference. We don't know the days that will change our lives, probably just as well. On the day that will change his, Jonesy is in his third-floor John Jay College office, looking out at his little slice of Boston, and thinking how wrong T.S. Eliot had been to call April the cruelest month, just because an itinerant carpenter from Nazareth supposedly got himself crucified then for fomenting rebellion. Anyone who lives in Boston knows that it's March that's the cruelest, holding out a few days of false hope, and then gleefully hitting you with the shit. Today is one of the untrustworthy ones when it looks as if spring might really be coming, and he's thinking about taking a walk when the bit of impending nastiness just ahead is over. Of course, at this point, Jonesy has no idea how nasty a day can get. No idea that he's going to finish this one in a hospital room, smashed up and fighting for his goddamn life. Same shit, different day, he thinks. But this will be different shit indeed. That's when the phone rings and he grabs it at once, filled with a hopeful premonition. It'll be the Defuniak kid calling to cancel his 11 o'clock. He's gotten a whiff of what's in the wind, Jonesy thinks, and that is very possible. Usually it's the students who make appointments to see the teacher. When a kid gets a message saying that one of his teachers wants to see him, well, you don't have to be a rocket scientist, as the saying goes. Hello, it's Jones, he says. Hey, Jonesy, how's life treating you? He'd know that voice anywhere. Henry, hey, good, life's good. Life does not, in fact, seem all that great, not with Defuniak due in a quarter of an hour, but it's all relative, isn't it? Compared to where he's going to be 12 hours from now, hooked up to all those beeping machines, one operation behind him and three more ahead of him, Jonesy is, as they say, farting through silk. Glad to hear it. Jonesy might have heard the heaviness in Henry's voice, but more likely it's a thing he senses. Henry, what's wrong? Silence. Jonesy is about to ask again when Henry answers. A patient of mine died yesterday. I happened to see the obit in the paper. Barry Newman, his name was. Henry pauses. He was a couch man. Jonesy doesn't know what that means, but his old friend is hurting. He knows that. Suicide? Heart attack. At the age of 29. Dug his grave with his own fork and spoon. I'm sorry. He hasn't been my patient for almost 2 years. I scared him away. I had one of those things. Do you know what I'm talking about? Jonesy thinks he does. Was it the line? Henry sighs. It doesn't sound like regret to Jonesy. It sounds like relief. Yeah, I kind of socked it to him. He took off like his ass was on fire. That doesn't make you responsible for his coronary. Maybe you're right, but that's not the way it feels. A pause. And then, with a shade of amusement, isn't that a line from a Jim Croce song? Are you all right, Jonesy? Me? Yeah, why do you ask? I don't know, Henry says. Only, I've been thinking about you ever since I opened the paper and saw Barry's picture on the obituary page. I want you to be careful. Around his bones, many of which will soon be broken, Jonesy feels a slight coldness. What exactly are you talking about? I don't know, Henry says. Maybe nothing, but is it the line now? Jonesy is alarmed. He swings around in his chair and looks out the window at the chancy spring sunlight. It crosses his mind that maybe the Defuniak kid is disturbed. Maybe he's carrying a gun, packing heat, as they say, in the mystery and suspense novels Jonesy likes to read in his spare time, and Henry has somehow picked this up. I don't know. The most likely thing is that I'm having a displaced reaction from seeing Barry's picture on the All Done page. But watch yourself the next little while, would you? Well, yeah, I can do that. Good. And you're okay? I'm fine. But Jonesy doesn't think Henry is fine at all. He's about to say something else when someone clears his throat behind him and he realizes that Defuniak has probably arrived. Well, that's good, he says, and swivels around in his chair. Yep, there's his 11 o'clock in the doorway, not looking dangerous at all. Just a kid bundled into a big old duffel coat that's too heavy for the day, looking thin and underfed, wearing one earring and a punky haircut that spikes over his worried eyes. Henry, I've got an appointment. I'll call you back. No, that's not necessary, really. You sure? I am. But there's one other thing. Got 30 more seconds? Sure, you bet. He holds up a finger to Defuniak, and Defuniak nods. But he just goes on standing there until Jonesy points to the one chair in the little office besides his own that isn't stacked with books. Defuniak goes to it reluctantly. Into the phone, Jonesy says, Shoot. I think we ought to go back to Derry. Just a quick trip, just you and me. See our old friend. You mean... But he doesn't want to say that name, that baby-sounding name, with a stranger in the room. He doesn't have to. Henry says it for him. Once they were a quartet, then for a little while they were five, and then they were four again. But the fifth one has never exactly left them. Henry says that name, the name of a boy who is magically still a boy. About him, Henry's worries are more clear, more easily expressed. It isn't anything he knows, he tells Jonesy, just a feeling that their old pal might need a visit. Have you talked to his mother? Jonesy asks. I think, Henry says, it might be better if we just, you know, orbited on in there. How's your calendar look for this weekend, or the one after? Jonesy doesn't need to check. The weekend starts day after tomorrow. There's a faculty thing Saturday afternoon, but he can easily get clear of that. I'm fine both days this weekend, he says. If I was to come by Saturday at 10, that'd be fine. Henry sounds relieved, more like himself. Jonesy relaxes a little. You're sure? If you think we ought to go see... Jonesy hesitates. See Douglas, then probably we should. It's been too long. Your appointment's there, isn't he? Uh-huh. Okay, I'll look for you at 10 on Saturday. Hey, maybe we'll take the scout. Give it a run. How would that be? That would be terrific. Henry laughs. Carla's still making your lunch, Jonesy? She is. Jonesy looks toward his briefcase. What you got today? Tuna fish? Egg salad? Mm-mm. Okay, I'm out of here. SSDD, right? SSDD, Jonesy agrees. He can't call their old friend by his right name in front of a student, but SSDD is all right. Talk to you later and take care of yourself. I mean it. The emphasis in Henry's voice is unmistakable and a little scary. But before Jonesy can respond, and what he would say with Defuniak sitting in the corner watching and listening he doesn't know, Henry is gone. Jonesy looks at the phone thoughtfully for a moment, then hangs up. He flips a page on his desk calendar, and on Saturday he crosses out drinks at Dean Jacobson's house and writes beg off going to Derry with Henry to see D. But this is an appointment he will not keep. By Saturday, Derry and his old friends will be the furthest things from his mind. Jonesy pulls in a deep breath, lets it out, and transfers his attention to his troublesome 11 o'clock. The kid shifts uncomfortably in his chair. He has a pretty good idea why he's been summoned here, Jonesy guesses. So, Mr. Defuniak, he says, you're from Maine, according to your records.
Yeah. Pittsfield.
Your records also say that you're here on scholarship, and that you've done well. The kid, he sees, is actually a lot more than worried. The kid is on the verge of tears. Christ, but this is hard. Jonesy has never had to accuse a student of cheating before, but he supposes this won't be the last time. He only hopes it doesn't happen too often, because this is hard, what Beaver would call a fuck-a-row. Mr. Defuniak. David, do you know what happens to scholarships if the students holding them are caught cheating, on a midterm exam, let us say? The kid jerks as if a hidden prankster under his chair has just triggered a low-voltage electrical charge into one of his skinny buttocks. Now his lips are trembling, and the first tear, oh God, there it goes, down his unshaven boy's cheek. I can tell you, Jonesy says, such scholarships evaporate. That's what happens to them. Poof, and gone into thin air. There's a folder on Jonesy's desk. He opens it and takes out a European history midterm, one of those multiple-choice monstrosities upon which the department, in its great unwisdom, insists. Written on top of this one, in the black strokes of an IBM pencil, make sure your marks are heavy and unbroken if you need to erase, erase completely, is the name David Defuniak. I've reviewed your coursework, David. I've rescanned your paper on feudalism in France during the Middle Ages. I've even been through your transcripts. You haven't exhibited brilliance, but you've done okay. And I'm aware that you're simply satisfying a requirement here. Your real interests don't lie in my field, do they? Defuniak shakes his head mutely. The tears gleam on his cheeks in that untrustworthy mid-March sunlight. There's a box of Kleenex on the corner of Jonesy's desk, and he tosses it to the boy, who catches it easily even in his distress. Good reflexes. When you're 19, all your wiring is still nice and tight, all your connections nice and solid. Wait a few years, Mr. Defuniak, he thinks. I'm only 37, and already some of my wires are getting loose. Maybe you deserve another chance, Jonesy says. Slowly and deliberately, he begins to crumple Defuniak's midterm, which is suspiciously perfect, A-plus work, into a ball. Maybe what happened is you were sick the day of the midterm, and you never took it at all. I was sick, David Defuniak says eagerly. I think I had the flu. Then maybe I ought to give you a take-home essay instead of the multiple-choice test to which your colleagues have been subjected, if you want it, to make up for the test you missed. Would you want that?
Yeah,
the kid says, wiping his eyes madly with a large swatch of tissues. At least he hasn't gone through all that small-time cheap-shit stuff about how Jonesy can't prove a thing, he'd take it to the Student Affairs Council, he'd call a protest, blah, 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 da, blah. He's crying instead, which is uncomfortable to witness, but probably a good sign. 19 is young, but too many of them have lost most of their consciences by the time they get there. Defuniak has pretty much owned up, which suggests there might still be a man in there waiting to come out.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And you understand that if anything like this ever happens again...
It won't, the kid says fervently. It won't, Professor Jones.
Although Jonesy is only an associate professor, he doesn't bother to correct him. Someday, after all, he will be Professor Jones. He better be. He and his wife have a house full of kids, and if there aren't at least a few salary bumps in his future, life is apt to be a pretty tough scramble. They've had some tough scrambles already. I hope not, he says. Give me 3,000 words on the short-term results of the Norman conquest, David, all right? Cite sources, but no need of footnotes. Keep it informal, but present a cogent thesis. I want it by next Monday. Understood?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Then why don't you go on and get started? He points at Defuniak's tatty footwear. And the next time you think of buying beer, buy some new sneakers instead. I wouldn't want you to catch the flu again. Defuniak goes to the door, then turns. He is anxious to be gone before Mr. Jones changes his mind, but he is also 19 and curious.
How did you know? You weren't even there that day.
Some grad student proctored the test. I knew, and that's enough, Jonesy says with some asperity. Go on, son. Write a good paper. Hold on to your scholarship. I'm from Maine myself, Derry, and I know Pittsfield. It's a better place to be from than to go back to. You got that right, Defuniak says fervently. Thank you. Thank you for giving me a chance. Close the door on your way out. Defuniak, who will spend his sneaker money not on beer but on a get-well bouquet for Jonesy, goes out, obediently closing the door behind him. Jonesy swings around and looks out the window again. The sunshine is untrustworthy but enticing, and because the Defuniak thing went better than he had expected, he thinks he wants to get out in that sunlight before more March clouds and maybe snow come rolling in. He has planned to eat in his office, but a new plan occurs to him. It is absolutely the worst plan of his life, but of course Jonesy doesn't know that. The plan is to grab his briefcase, pick up a copy of the Boston Phoenix, and walk across the river to Cambridge. He'll sit on a bench and eat his egg salad sandwich in the sun. He gets up to put Defuniak's file in the cabinet marked D to F. How did you know? The boy had asked. And Jonesy supposes that was a good question. An excellent question, really. The answer is this. He knew because sometimes he does. That's the truth, and there's no other. If someone put a gun to his head, he'd say he found out during the first class after the midterm that it was right there in front of David Defuniak's mind, big and bright, flashing on and off in guilty red neon. Cheater, cheater, cheater. But man, that's dope. He can't read minds. He never could. Never ever, never ever, never ever could. Sometimes things flash into his head. Yes, he knew about his wife's problems with pills that way, and he supposes he might have known in that same way that Henry was depressed when he called. No, it was in his voice, doofus, that's all it was. But stuff like that hardly ever happens anymore. There has been nothing really odd since the business with Josie Rinkenhauer. Maybe there was something once, and maybe it trailed them out of their childhoods and adolescence, but surely it is gone now, or almost gone. Almost. He circles the words, going to Derry, on his desk calendar, then grabs his briefcase. As he does, a new thought comes to him, sudden and meaningless, but very powerful. Watch out for Mr. Gray. He stops, with one hand on his doorknob. That was his own voice, no doubt about it. What? He asks the empty room. Nothing. Jonesy steps out of his office, closes the door, and tests the lock. In the corner of his door's bulletin board is a blank white card. Jonesy unpins it and turns it over. On the flip side is the printed message, "Back at 1. Until then, I'm history." He pins the message side to the bulletin board with perfect confidence, but it will be almost 2 months before Jonesy enters this room again and sees his desk calendar still turned to St. Patrick's Day. "Take care of yourself," Henry said. But Jonesy isn't thinking about taking care of himself. He's thinking about March sunlight. He's thinking about eating his sandwich. He's thinking he might watch a few girls over on the Cambridge side. Skirts are short, and March winds are frisky. He's thinking about all sorts of things, but watching out for Mr. Gray isn't one of them. Neither is taking care of himself. This is a mistake. This is also how lives change forever.
Part 1. Cancer. This shaking keeps me steady. I should know. What falls away is always, and is near. I wake to sleep, and take my waking slow. I learn by going where I have to go. Theodore Ruthke.
Chapter 1. McCarthy. Jonesy almost shot the guy when he came out of the woods. How close? Another pound on the Garand's trigger, maybe just a half. Later, hyped on the clarity that sometimes comes to the horrified mind, he wished he had shot before he saw the orange cap and the orange flagman's vest. Killing Richard McCarthy couldn't have hurt, and it might have helped. Killing McCarthy might have saved them all. Pete and Henry had gone to Goslin's Market, the closest store, to stock up on bread, canned goods, and beer, the real essential. They had plenty for another 2 days, but the radio said there might be snow coming. Henry had already gotten his deer, a good-sized doe, and Jonesy had an idea Pete cared a lot more about making sure of the beer supply than he did about getting his own deer. For Pete Moore, hunting was a hobby, beer a religion. The beaver was out there someplace, but Jonesy hadn't heard the crack of a rifle any closer than 5 miles, so he guessed that the beav, like him, was still waiting. There was a stand in an old maple about 70 yards from the camp, and that was where Jonesy was, sipping coffee and reading a Robert Parker mystery novel, when he heard something coming and put the book and the thermos aside. In other years, he might have spilled the coffee in his excitement, but not this time. This time, he even took a few seconds to screw on the thermos's bright red stopper. The four of them had been coming up here to hunt in the first week of November for 26 years, if you counted in the times Beeve's dad had taken them, and Jonesy had never bothered with the tree stand until now. None of them had. It was too confining. This year, Jonesy had staked it out. The others thought they knew why, but they only knew half of it. In mid-March of 2001, Jonesy had been struck by a car while crossing a street in Cambridge, not far from John Jay College, where he taught. He had fractured his skull, broken 2 ribs, and suffered a shattered hip, which had been replaced with some exotic combination of Teflon and metal. The man who'd struck him was a retired BU history professor who was, according to his lawyer anyway, in the early stages of Alzheimer's, more to be pitied than punished. So often, Jonesy thought, there was no one to blame when the dust cleared. And even if there was, what good did it do? You still had to live with what was left, and console yourself with the fact that, as people told him every day, until they forgot the whole thing, that was, it could have been worse. And it could have been. His head was hard, and the crack in it healed. He had no memory of the hour or so leading up to his accident near Harvard Square, but the rest of his metal equipment was fine. His ribs healed in a month. The hip was the worst, but he was off the crutches by October, and now his limp only became appreciable toward the end of the day. Pete, Henry, and the beeve thought it was the hip, and only the hip, that had caused him to opt for the tree stand instead of the damp, cold woods, and the hip was certainly a factor, just not the only one. What he had kept from them was that he now had little interest in shooting deer. It would have dismayed them. Hell, it dismayed Jonesy himself. But there it was, something new in his existence that he hadn't even suspected until they had actually gotten up here on November 11th, and he had uncased the Garand. He wasn't revolted by the idea of hunting, not at all. He just had no real urge to do it. Death had brushed by him on a sunny day in March, and Jonesy had no desire to call it back, even if he were dealing rather than receiving. What surprised him was that he still liked being at camp, in some ways better than ever. Talking at night, books, politics, the shit they'd gotten up to as kids, their plans for the future. They were in their 30s, still young enough to have plans, plenty of them, and the old bond was still strong. And the days were good, too. The hours in the tree stand when he was alone. He took a sleeping bag and slid into it up to his hips when he got cold, and a book, and a Walkman. After the first day, he stopped listening to the Walkman, discovering that he liked the music of the woods better. The silk of the wind in the pines, the rust of the crows. He would read a little, drink coffee, read a little more, sometimes work his way out of the sleeping bag, it was as red as a stoplight, and piss off the edge of the platform. He was a man with a big family and a large circle of colleagues. A gregarious man who enjoyed all the various relationships the family and the colleagues entailed, and the students, of course, the endless stream of students, and balanced them well. It was only out here, up here, that he realized the attractions of silence were still real, still strong. It was like meeting an old friend after a long absence. "You sure you want to be up there, man?" Henry had asked him yesterday morning. I mean, you're welcome to come out with me. We won't overuse that leg of yours, I promise. Leave him alone, Pete said. He likes it up there, don't you, Jones boy? Sort of, he said, unwilling to say much more. How much he actually did like it, for instance. Some things you didn't feel safe telling even your closest friends. And sometimes your closest friends knew, anyway. Tell you something, the beeve said. He picked up a pencil and began to gnaw lightly at it, his oldest, dearest trick going all the way back to first grade. I like coming back and seeing you there. Like a lookout in the crow's nest in one of those fucking hornblower books. Keeping an eye out, you know? Sail ho, Jonesy had said. And they all laughed, but Jonesy knew what the beeve meant. He felt it, keeping an eye out. Just thinking his thoughts and keeping an eye out for ships or sharks or who knew what. His hip hurt coming back down. The pack with his shit in it was heavy on his back, and he felt slow and clumsy on the wooden rungs nailed to the trunk of the maple, but that was okay. Good, in fact. Things changed, but only a fool believed that they only changed for the worse. That was what he thought then. When he heard the whicker of moving brush and the soft snap of a twig, sounds he never questioned were those of an approaching deer, Jonesy thought of something his father said. You can't make yourself be lucky. Lindsay Jones was one of life's losers, and had said few things worth committing to memory, but that was one, and here was the proof of it again. Days after deciding he had finished with deer hunting, here came one, and a big one by the sound, a buck almost surely, maybe one as big as a man. That it was a man never so much as crossed Jonesy's mind. This was an unincorporated township, 50 miles north of Rangeley, and the nearest hunters were 2 hours' walk away. The nearest paved road, the one which eventually took you to Goslin's Market, beer, bait, out-of-state licenses, lottery ticks, was at least 16 miles away. Well, he thought, it isn't as if I took a vow or anything. No, he hadn't taken a vow. Next November he might be up here with a Nikon instead of a Garand, but it wasn't next year yet, and the rifle was at hand. He had no intention of looking a gift deer in the mouth. Jonesy screwed the red stopper into the thermos of coffee and put it aside. Then he pushed the sleeping bag off his lower body like a big quilted sock, wincing at the stiffness in his hip as he did it, and grabbed his gun. There was no need to chamber a round, producing that loud, deer-frightening click. Old habits die hard, and the gun was ready to fire as soon as he thumbed off the safety. This he did when he was solidly on his feet. The old wild excitement was gone, but there was a residue. His pulse was up, and he welcomed the rise. In the wake of his accident, he welcomed all such reactions. It was as if there were two of him now, the one before he had been knocked flat in the street, and the warier, older fellow who had awakened in Mass General, if you could call that slow, drugged awareness being awake. Sometimes he still heard a voice, whose he didn't know, but not his, calling out, "Please stop. I can't stand it. Give me a shot. Where's Marcy? I want Marcy." He thought of it as Death's voice. Death had missed him in the street and had then come to the hospital to finish the job, Death masquerading as a man, or perhaps it had been a woman, it was hard to tell, in pain. Someone who said Marcy, but meant Jonesy. The idea passed. All the funny ideas he'd had in the hospital eventually passed, but it left a residue. Caution was the residue. He had no memory of Henry calling and telling him to watch himself for the next little while, and Henry hadn't reminded him. But since then, Jonesy had watched himself. He was careful, because maybe death was out there, and maybe, sometimes, it called your name. But the past was the past. He had survived his brush with death, and nothing was dying here this morning but a deer, a buck, he hoped, who had strolled in the wrong direction. The sound of the rustling brush and snapping twigs was coming toward him from the southwest, which meant he wouldn't have to shoot around the trunk of the maple, good, and put him upwind. Even better. Most of the maple's leaves had fallen, and he had a good, if not perfect, sight line through the interlacing branches. Jonesy raised the Garand, settled the butt plate into the hollow of his shoulder, and prepared to shoot himself a conversation piece. What saved McCarthy, at least temporarily, was Jonesy's disenchantment with hunting. What almost got McCarthy killed was a phenomenon George Kilroy, a friend of his father's, had called eye fever. Eye fever, Kilroy claimed, was a form of buck fever and was probably the second most common cause of hunting accidents.
First is drink, said George Kilroy,
and, like Jonesy's father, Kilroy knew a bit on that subject as well.
First is always drink.
Kilroy said that victims of eye fever were uniformly astounded to discover they had shot a fence post, or a passing car, or the broadside of a barn, or their own hunting partner. In many cases, the partner was a spouse, a sib, or a child.
But I saw it, they would protest,
and most of them, according to Kilroy, could pass a lie detector test on the subject. They had seen the deer, or the bear, or the wolf, or just the grouse flip-flapping through the high autumn grass. They had seen it. What happened, according to Kilroy, was that these hunters were afflicted by an anxiety to make the shot, to get it over with, one way or the other. This anxiety became so strong that the brain persuaded the eye that it saw what was not yet visible in order to end the tension. This was eye fever. And although Jonesy was aware of no particular anxiety, his fingers had been perfectly steady as he screwed the red stopper back into the throat of the thermos, he admitted later to himself that, yes, he might have fallen prey to the malady. For one moment, he saw the buck clearly at the end of the tunnel made by the interlocking branches, as clearly as he had seen any of the previous 16 deer, 6 bucks, 10 does, he had brought down over the years at Hole in the Wall. He saw its brown head, one eye so dark it was almost the black of jeweler's velvet, even part of its rack. "Shoot now," part of him cried. It was the Jonesy from the other side of the accident, the whole Jonesy. That one had spoken more frequently in the last month or so as he began to approach some mythical state which people who had never been hit by a car blithely referred to as total recovery, but he had never spoken as loudly as he did now. This was a command, almost a shout. And his finger did tighten on the trigger. It never put on that last pound of pressure, or perhaps it only would have taken another half, a paltry 8 ounces, but it did tighten. The voice that stopped him was that second Jonesy, the one who had awakened in Mass General, doped and disoriented and in pain, not sure of anything anymore except that someone wanted something to stop. Someone couldn't stand it, not without a shot anyway, that someone wanted Marcy.
No, not yet. Wait. Watch, this new cautious Jonesy said,
and that was the voice he listened to. He froze in place, most of his weight thrown forward on his good left leg, rifle raised, barrel angled down that interlacing tunnel of light at a cool 35 degrees. The first flakes of snow came skating down out of the white sky just then, and as they did, Jonesy saw a bright vertical line of orange below the deer's head. It was as if the snow had somehow conjured it up. For a moment, perception simply gave up, and what he was seeing over the barrel of his gun became only an unconnected jumble, like paints swirled all together on an artist's palette. There was no deer and no man, not even any woods, just a puzzling and untidy jumble of black, brown, and orange. Then there was more orange, and in a shape that made sense. It was a hat, the kind with flaps you could fold down to cover your ears. The out-of-staters bought them at L.L. Bean's for $44, each with a little tag inside that said proudly made in the USA by union labor. Or you could pick one up at Goslin's for $7. The tag in a Goslin's cap just said made in Bangladesh. The hat brought everything into horrible oh God focus. The brown he had mistaken for a buck's head was the front of a man's wool jacket. The black jeweler's velvet of the buck's eye was a button, and the antlers were only more branches, branches belonging to the very tree in which he was standing. The man was unwise. Jonesy could not quite bring himself to use the word crazy, to be wearing a brown coat in the woods. But Jonesy was still at a loss to understand how he himself could have made a mistake of such potentially horrifying consequence. Because as the man was also wearing an orange cap, wasn't he? and a bright orange flagman's vest as well over the admittedly unwise brown coat. The man was a pound of finger pressure from death, maybe less. It came home to him in a visceral way then, knocking him clean out of his own body. For a terrible, brilliant moment he never forgot, he was neither Jonesy number one, the confident pre-accident Jonesy, or Jonesy number two, the more tentative survivor who spent so much of his time in a tiresome state of physical discomfort and mental confusion. For that moment, he was some other Jonesy, an invisible presence looking at a gunman standing on a platform in a tree. A gunman's hair was short and already graying, his face lined around the mouth, beard speckled on the cheeks and haggard. The gunman was on the verge of using his weapon. Snow had begun to dance around his head and light on his untucked brown flannel shirt, and he was on the verge of shooting a man in an orange cap and vest of the very sort he would have been wearing himself if he had elected to go into the woods with the beaver instead of up into this tree. He fell back into himself with a thud, exactly as one fell back into one's seat after taking a car over a bad bump at a high speed. To his horror, he realized he was still tracking the man below with the Garand, as if some stubborn alligator deep in his brain refused to let go of the idea that the man in the brown coat was prey. Worse, he couldn't seem to make his finger relax on the rifle's trigger. There was even an awful second or two when he thought he was actually still squeezing, inexorably eating up those last few ounces between him and the greatest mistake of his life. He later came to accept that that at least had been an illusion, something akin to the feeling you get of rolling backward in your stopped car when you glimpse a slowly moving car beside you out of the corner of your eye. No, he was just frozen. But that was bad enough. That was hell. Jonesy, you think too much, Pete liked to say when he caught Jonesy staring out into the middle distance, no longer tracking the conversation, and what he probably meant was, Jonesy, you imagine too much. And that was very likely true. Certainly he was imagining too much now as he stood up here in the middle of the tree and the season's first snow, hair leaping up in tufts, finger locked on the Garand's trigger, not tightening still as he had for a moment feared, but not loosening either. The man almost below him now, the Garand's gun sight on the top of the orange cap, the man's life on an invisible wire between the Garand's muzzle and that cap. The man may be thinking about trading his car, or cheating on his wife, or buying his oldest daughter a pony. Jonesy later had reason to know McCarthy had been thinking about none of those things, but of course not then, not in the tree with his forefinger a frozen curl around the trigger of his rifle. And not knowing what Jonesy had not known as he stood on the curb in Cambridge, with his briefcase in one hand and a copy of the Boston Phoenix under his arm, namely, that death was in the neighborhood. Or perhaps even death, a hurrying figure, like something escaped from an early Ingmar Bergman film, something carrying a concealed implement in the coarse folds of its robe, scissors perhaps, or a scalpel. And the worst of it was that the man would not die, or at least not at once. He would fall down and lie there screaming, as Jonesy had lain screaming in the street. He couldn't remember screaming, but of course he had. He had been told this, and had no reason to disbelieve it. Screamed his fucking head off, most likely. And what if the man in the brown coat and orange accessories started screaming for Marcy? Surely he would not. Not really. But Jonesy's mind might report screams of Marcy. If there was eye fever, if he could look at a man's brown coat and see it as a deer's head, then there was likely the auditory equivalent as well. To hear a man screaming and know you were the reason. Dear God, no. And still, his finger would not loosen.